What the EFL? It's the new Independent Football League podcast, bringing you all the very best insight, expertise and irreverence as pertains to the English Football League. On this episode, Schofield looking for a new job this morning after Terriers say Willoughby needing a new manager. The Great British Baker gets Alex Neil off and running, and there are three twos here, there and everywhere. Slicker than a Sunderland counter-attack. Welcome to What the EFL. Hello, listener. Thanks for joining us again, or maybe for the very first time. It's me, Matt Davis-Adams here. We're a little later than usual. That's because there was no football for us to talk about last weekend. Thankfully, though, there's been plenty going on in the Football League this midweek. I'm joined, as ever, by Sam Parkin.
Hello, Matt.
And Adrian Clark's with us too. Hi, Adrian.
Hello. Better late than never, hey?
Right, later, another EFL icon will take the fit and proper guest test. But first, let's get into some news. Well, the big news that's broken this week is that Danny Schofield has been sacked by Huddersfield. Only won one of his nine games in charge after being promoted from the coaching staff when Carlos Corberan left. He lost seven of those games, the final straw being the 2-1 home defeat to Wigan on Tuesday. Here's what Chief Exec Dean Hoyle had to say to BBC Leeds over the summer. Danny had been offered a job on the continent and he wanted to take it. As disappointed as we are to have lost Carlos, and we are, thank goodness we kept hold of Danny because he was the succession plan and always had been. The succession plan didn't last very long, Adrian. It's a difficult one, this, isn't it? Because those comments make Huddersfield look a bit silly. But then from what we've seen on the pitch, you can kind of understand the decision.
Yeah, those quotes do sound silly now, don't they? Why was he the succession plan? What had they seen in Danny Schofield to think that he could be the guy to take them forward? That would be my immediate question to them. It just felt to me, even though he's clearly a very good coach, there's no doubt that he knows how to coach players. He knows football, loves the club. He's in touch with the fans and, you know, there's a great rapport there. But it's a big difference, isn't it? Being the manager to being a good coach. You need a lot more than just coaching ability to succeed in that role. I think it was a risky move to go with him. Felt a little bit like he was thrown in at the deep end. And we have to remember it, that he followed a very strong-minded, distinctive manager in Carlos Corberan, who really sort of had his own quirky ideas that worked by and large last season. But that it's a difficult act to follow, in my opinion. And I feel sorry for him because now he's no longer working at the club. He clearly has strong affection for him.
What about who follows him then, Sam? Adrian says it's a difficult act. David Wagner seems to be the early favourite with the bookies to come back and bore us all to death again. Anthony Barry, Michael Carrick also in the running. Any of those names particularly stand out to you, Barry? Somebody we know a bit about from our Chelsea work?
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see him get a go, as it would be Michael Carrick. I suppose it's where they want to go right now. Do they want to go for someone who is going to shore them up and give them the best chance of survival? Or is it going to be another kind of exciting experimental appointment like Corbran was? So that's up to Lee Bromby, an old friend of mine, an old teammate of mine from England under 18s, and the powers that be to make that decision. But yeah, I don't know. I think looking at this, maybe he just tried to change a little bit too much. You think about the success of last season. I know they started the new campaign in a different shape and a slightly different style, and they got off to the worst possible start, lost their first three games. So I know new managers will want to put their own stamp on it. That's only natural, but I thought they had such great success last year. It was probably a good idea to follow suit to a degree. So yeah, not a great start. And I think when you've got 8 or 9 of your players under par, that kind of falls at the manager's door, doesn't it? If there's 1 or 2, and I saw Thomas, for example, has been off colour in comparison to last year. I think when it's the majority of the squad, then obviously the manager's time's up.
His time's up. Dino Marmria, though, is the permanent Burton manager. This, according to Dino Marmria, he stepped up from assistant when Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank left. Marmria said of a conversation he had with owner Ben Robinson, "We spoke about the caretaker thing and I said, I'm not really. Caretaker isn't helping anybody. I want to know where I stand. I want to speak to the players about where I stand. This is not a short-term fix. It's a long-term fix. I am the full-time manager of Burton Albion Football Club. Clarkie, I checked his LinkedIn page. He hasn't updated that yet. It still says assistant on there. But this is interesting, isn't it? I mean, maybe I've missed it, but I've scoured Burton's website. I've looked through their socials. There hasn't been an official announcement. Can you just claim yourself manager? If so, am I the manager of this podcast?
He just stuck his flag in the middle of the centre circle, hasn't he, at the Pirelli, and he said, this is my club. It's quite bold, isn't it? A bit brazen of him. It doesn't really matter what he's called. The bottom line is they'll fire him if they don't start winning games soon, whether he's the caretaker or whether he's the sort of self-appointed permanent manager of Burton. It doesn't help, does it, that they're in limbo. It doesn't help that there's been no real sort of communication from the club in terms of what is going on moving forward. Are they looking for a new gaffer or aren't they? It's all a little bit strange. I get why Dino will be wanting to be strong and forceful. And I kind of admire the attitude towards it. But he will be gone soon unless he can turn the team around. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, they're having a bit of a stinker at the moment, albeit a tough game in midweek. Sam, you and I both have toddlers of around the same age. Mine's in the mine phase at the moment. Everything is mine, according to him. Strong kind of energy of that to this with Dino Marmaria. If you just say it's yours, does that make it yours?
None of us would argue with him. So I wouldn't imagine there's anyone at Burton Albion in the boardroom that's going to take that on either. He is an absolute unit, isn't he?
He's a muscular geezer, isn't he?
Yeah, I thought there was a period at Stevenage where, yeah, various shots of him scared the living daylights out of me. So, yeah.
If anyone, what it does to me.
Maybe that could help him get some results in the short term, just scaring the life out of the players. But no, I just can't see the results turning around there. I don't think the recruitment was particularly good. Again, you think back to the recent success of Burton. Think of that watertight defence. Immediately turned things around. Jimmy Floyd Hasselbaink and Dino Marmaria when they went in there. And they can't defend at the moment. They've lost their main goal threat, Ahadmi. Adrian spoke about that on one of the previous podcasts. And Keeler Dunn is doing his utmost. I think he's got three, but I look at the options in attack and where are they going to get the goals to turn things around? So if you're not functioning correctly at either end of the pitch, it could be a long, arduous season for Burton and their supporters. So is he the right man? I'm not so sure. Maybe it would be a positive to get a new voice in there, just to, some new ideas and freshen things up.
I think so. You can always tell how strong or weak a team is by the away form, in my opinion. And their away form is appalling. I don't think they've conceded fewer than two on the road this season so far. So, yeah, that's the first job, tighten them up at the back.
Go to Exeter at the weekend, which is not an easy game for them. Some headlines from midweek in the Football League. In the Championship, Redick Hadra struck a stoppage-time winner for Sheffield United at Swansea to keep the Blades top of the pile. Norwich keeping pace with them by beating Bristol City 3-2 on Wednesday. Scott Hogan's hat-trick gave Birmingham their first win at West Brom in 18 years. Yet another 3-2 there. There were also big wins for Rotherham and Sunderland. In League One, Ipswich and Portsmouth both have 20 points. They've both yet to lose. They lead the way after midweek wins against Bristol Rovers and Burton, respectively. Defeat for the Brewers means they and Morecambe are the only teams yet to win in League One this season. Whilst in League Two, Leighton Orient's 1-0 win at bottom side Rochdale keeps them top and unbeaten. Barrow beat Doncaster 2-0 and have given Pete Wilde a new contract. Yeah, that's the Pete Wilde who was only appointed over the summer. He said, I'm very humbled and surprised. Me too, Adrian. This is strange. Was he on sort of like a rolling contract that we didn't know about? Was he on rubbish money and they've upped it? Something strange is going on here.
I've looked into this. He signed a three-year deal, so it must be a mega long contract. Do you know what I think might have happened here? I think they've gone for the Potter effect. They've seen what Brighton have done with Graham Potter, inserting that sort of buyout clause, if you like. 20 million it cost Chelsea, didn't it, to take him away. And I suspect they view Pete Wilde as somebody that will be plucked by a club that's bigger than them in the years to come. So they may be offering themselves a little bit more protection. I'm sure it won't be £20 million, but they're after a few quid. That's the only logical explanation I can think of for giving him a new deal already. But good on him. You'd do it. You'd sign it, wouldn't you? Every day of the week.
100%. Good luck to him. All right. Okay. We're going to go deeper on some of the midweek matchups next. First of all, though, I should point you in the way of our socials at EFL What The on Twitter. Do give us a follow. And if you're interested in sponsoring the show, you can email whattheefl@yahoo.com and we'll have a conversation about it. Also, if you could give us a 5-star review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, if you think we're worth it, that would help us out tremendously. It means that the podcast gets more visibility and more people can hear about it. All right, midweek's next. So we're going to take a look at a couple of the significant games in each division. Adrian, you want to talk about Alex Neil getting off the mark as Stoke manager. His Potters won 3-0 at Hull on Tuesday. Inspired by Lewis Baker, he's somebody who we talked about at the back end of the Totally Football League show after he came in January. He's got to be one of the best signings in the EFL this year, hasn't he? He's already captain and he makes them tick.
I think so. Yeah, credit Sam where it's due. I think when they signed him, he bigged up the acquisition, said it was a bit of a game changer for them. They'd done ever so well to get him, and so it's proved. He's had 19 shots from outside the box already this season. That's the joint highest in the Championship, sharing that with Norwich's Marcelino Nunez. The next closest, by the way, is Brereton Diaz on 14. So he loves a pop from distance. I don't think any midfielder's had more shots in total than him either. 4 goals, 2 assists. I mean, in this game, he was brilliant. The first goal was deflected. The second goal was from him. Was just awesome. Lovely little triangle, wasn't it, with Dwight Gale and Liam Delap. And then he whips the curler into the bottom corner. It was a beauty. And that was his assist, by the way, from a free kick. A lovely delivery for Ben Wilmot to score. So, yeah, he had a dream game. He's having a terrific season. And, yes, Stoke City are no doubt very pleased. They made the decision to bring him in. So, yeah, this was a cracking result for Alex Neil, wasn't it? It's interesting, I thought, looking at the possession, because one of the last things Michael O'Neill said as Stoke manager, and I remember this because I talked about it on the radio, was I want us to become more of a possession-based side. Most of the teams that get promoted out of this league control matches with the ball. In this game, they had 35.3% of possession and they still had 20 shots. So Alex Neil's maybe looking at it slightly differently. Big up Jordan Thompson. He was excellent in defensive midfield. I think that's a key position for them. And also Jacob Brown, who... That's the big change he's made. Obviously, he's been doing a great job up front. He stuck him at right wing back, a la Potter with Raheem Sterling. He's just said, go and do a job for me out there. And I think he did it pretty well in this game. So, yeah, well done, Stoke. This was a great win.
Tough run ahead for them. QPR away, Watford home, Burnley away, Sheffield United at home. So I guess we'll know more about their prospects after that. Wonder if, from a whole perspective, Shota Arveladze needs a win at Swansea this weekend. 3 defeats on the spin, 4 in the last 5 for them.
Yeah, not great. They've faced 10 more shots in open play than anyone else, Hull. So even though they had this really good start to the season, they're letting other teams create a lot of chances against them. They're also absolutely terrible at defending set pieces. That's 6 they've let in as well. So, yeah, I think they may have been in a false position a couple of weeks ago. The XG stats will certainly tell you that. It's maybe they shouldn't have scored as many as they have, and they should have let in more than they have as well. So, yeah, maybe there's a levelling out going on at the MKM at the moment.
Meanwhile, Cardiff, Tuesday night, they were cruising at the Riverside, 3-0 up at half-time against Middlesbrough. They had to weather a fight back after the restart, eventually held on to win 3-2. I thought Steve Morrison channeled his inner Sam Parkin after the game with this quote: "We've scored 3 goals away at Middlesbrough. It's a tremendous performance." That is very, very Parkin for me, the word tremendous. Are you feeling glass half full or half empty today, Sam? Do you want to talk about Steve Morrison and his tremendous performance, or Chris Wilder, who to me looks like he'd rather be anywhere else but in the Middlesbrough dugout at the moment?
I think I often use a bit of creative license where Steve Morrison's involved, because he was an apprentice at Northampton when I was in the first team there. And I often say he cleaned my boots. I'm not entirely sure he did. He maybe just passed me my boots once upon a time. But yeah, maybe we are kindred spirits. And I thoroughly enjoyed the tussle with Chris Wilder. That was excellent. What was Wilder doing? It was genius. A little bit of a... Yeah, just I don't know what it was. Weird grapple without using arms or anything. It was brilliant. Just torsos. Excellent stuff. It really was. I'm glad that Cardiff have won, because when I raised the idea of doing kind of what the Cardiff looked like under Steve Morrison a few weeks ago, Matt, when they'd beaten Birmingham, you were very excited. We never got round to doing it. And subsequently, I think they've lost more or less every game. So I'm really pleased that I'm going to give them some credit. That said, I'd have had to tear up the bit of paper, because the system changed for this Middlesbrough victory from what has been a kind of 4-2-3-1, 4-3-3, really impressive midfield trio that I've enjoyed watching. He went 3-5-2 in this game. And I thought Callum Robinson had an immediate impact. They've spoken so much about this elusive striker because of Max Watters' struggles. I think 1 in 19 games he's had in the Cardiff shirt. They needed another body, another threat, and him and Harris were particularly good in this game. Harris got a goal. Robinson made the other two, made one for O'Dowda, their previous teammates from Robinson's brief spell at Bristol City. So that seemed to click immediately. And like Clarkey on the old possession a moment ago, Cardiff have been one of the biggest changes, I would say, maybe outside of Burnley, in terms of having Lowe's more of the ball. I mean, seventh for average possession. Well, in this game, right down, 32%, 272 passes, 227 of those short. Just to give you a comparison, against Bristol City a month ago, 55% possession, 413 passes, 396 short. So yes, they were 3-0 up and cruising, so didn't have much of the ball in the second half, but maybe just a little bit of a shift from being, you know, overly concerned about having the ball, dominating possession, and just, I don't know, just winning a football match, getting two up front, cutting a pass out, and not being too over elaborate in areas deep in your own half. So, yeah, change from Morrison, and obviously a massive win, huge win. Completely echo the tremendous notion that Morrison went for, and despite being a bit ragged towards the end, massive win.
Just a little nugget, Sam. I don't know if you know Darren Purse. He's in charge of the under-23s at Cardiff at the moment. Steve Morrison brought him in. And I was at a game at Birmingham recently. We ended up walking together towards the car. So we're having a bit of a chinwag and we're just chatting about it. And yeah, he's really, really enjoying it. But one line really stood out from what he said. He goes, "Oh, Steve Morrison, yeah, he's a good lad. He's brought me in, much appreciated, etc." He goes, "I'll tell you what though, Steve Morrison, he is brutal like that. He is ruthless." They were the words that he used. He said, so if Cardiff players aren't doing what he's asking, have a look at the changes that are made and maybe players being ostracised, because yeah, by all accounts, he doesn't mess around. But in that respect, I guess he's probably well suited to management, Sam.
You say that Chris Wilder used to be brutal, didn't he? But it just seems Mardy now. The defending was terrible. We were playing a team that weren't on a great run and we wanted to get out of the traps, but we certainly didn't do that. Is he going to be there by Christmas, Sam?
Doesn't feel like it, does it? But I can't keep making excuses for the squad because I think it's comparable, maybe not to the team that's going to win the league or get automatic promotion, but it should be challenging. I think now it's hard when you're looking at the 11 or you're critiquing the statistics, you're mulling over the statistics, you're looking at everything, because they all suggest that they should be doing slightly better. Only three teams have scored more than Middlesbrough. I think maybe the midfield is the area of weakness, a bit samey. Mowat, Crooks and Howson, certainly when he changed things in the second half, he put Dyke still on at right centre half. He put two up top. He put Watmore up there with Muniz and allowed McGree to be the number 10. That seemed to give them more joy. Obviously, they're chasing the game. Cardiff have probably declared at that point, but I think that's huge food for thought for Chris Wilder moving forward, because I just think they're looking a little bit leggy, in midfield and the tenacity and the energy of Cardiff and other side, the way they were set up, possibly going to cause them a problem. So a bit more mobility in the midfield. Other than that, I'm scratching. I'm struggling, to be honest, because they should be doing better.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go into League One, a thriller at the New Meadow, where Che Dunkley's stoppage time winner sealed a fabulous comeback for Shrewsbury, who were 2-0 down to Exeter after 20 minutes, but won 3-2, which I think every other team who played in the EFL this midweek won 3-2 by the looks of things. Clarkie, that Che Dunkley goal would have made the 200-mile drive home for the Grecian fans and players fly by, I'm sure, but a first home league win of the season for the Shrews and just a point outside the playoffs.
I know. I think both teams be pretty happy with where they are in the league. I think they're eighth and ninth, aren't they? Which is impressive. That goal, by the way, came from a long throw. If you class a long throw as a set piece, and I think they do over at Opta Towers, then it was the fifth set piece goal of that game. All of them stem from either corners, recycled corners, or set pieces. So quite remarkable, really. It was a great comeback. Obviously, 2-0 down to Exeter. That's a tough place to be when you haven't won at home. But they ground it out, didn't they? They're going to be so horrible to play against. I don't think there are going to be many pretty matches involving Shrewsbury Town this season. They don't keep the ball for long periods. They don't really play as a counter-attacking team. They're just a solid, well-organised, pretty direct team that feeds off second balls and set plays. So and they're going to make life awkward for everybody that they face. So yeah, great result. What I will say is that there's a little bit of stardust born in Coventry, in that attacking midfield position, the two positions behind the main striker, Bayliss and Shipley. Remember seeing these boys at Coventry, and they were talented young players. They've sort of had to take, I guess, what you'd regard as a drop down. But in that Shrewsbury team, they feel like stardust, and they've both scored in the last couple of games. I think at Forest Green, they'd combined with one another to score a really nice goal. So as functional as Shrewsbury are, I think Bayliss and Shipley will potentially win them games with moments of magic.
Also in League One, Lincoln got the better of Derby County. The score sheet read Diamond House, which I am convinced is a provincial nightclub that Sam and Adrian have frequented on a team bonding trip at some point. First meeting in 36 years, Derby's 5,000th match in the Football League, if you'll forgive me a little. Sam, tell me something about this game, please.
Mate, if me and Steve Morrison are kindred spirits, my first note on this game was just sensational for headline writers in the Lincolnshire region. Because they've got a pool, a diamond, a house, a virtue, and a bishop in their lineup. I mean, the geezer at the Lincoln Advertiser, he's just laughing, isn't he?
He's good.
Incredible scenes. But they thoroughly deserved this victory. I think Curtis Davis got a lot of praise post-match for just basically honestly saying that Lincoln were the better side. They pressed really well. I think that Derby are probably struggling with this fixture being everyone's cup final. And I know that's a hell of a cliche, but it's difficult when a team's been put together quite last minute. They're adapting to a new level. A lot of these guys are used to playing in the Championship or higher earlier on in their career. And they're coming up against sides that are giving them real problems because of the shift they're putting in first and foremost. This is a new team that Mark Kennedy's put together. So I think it's too early really to judge them. Only their second victory of the season. And very depleted at the moment as well. No Hopper, who's their main goal threat. No Walsh at the back. So, yeah, a lot of untested players really at this level, along with Diamond, who's come in. And he was excellent. He's going to have to carry the burden left by Anthony Scully, who's been a big player for Lincoln over the last couple of seasons. So great to see Diamond so sharp in this game, getting a goal and being brought down for the penalty and assist. And I think it was Ben House as well for the second. So thoroughly deserved victory. Derby, four games now away from home, not scored. Big problems there, big problems. And, again, I think that the midfield needs strengthening a little bit. I think Jason Knight's playing at right back at the moment and obviously really struggling for goals up top. So, yeah, a lot of work for Liam Rossignol to do.
Listener, you might well know that I'm a Forest fan. I promise I'm not going to dig Derby out every week, but I am just enjoying the schadenfreude at the moment. I remember when Forest got relegated to League One, you go through the initial mourning phase, and then you go into, actually, it's going to be quite nice to play some new teams and visit some new grounds. And then that quickly turns into, oh my God, we're going to be here forever. This is nowhere near as easy as we assumed it was going to be. Let's go into League Two. Crawley creeping away from the relegation zone after the Crypto Bros Co. picked up their first league win under Kevin Betsy. Another 3-2 here, this one against Stockport County. Clarkie, you've seen Betsy at close quarters from his time working with Arsenal's academy. How do you think he's making the transition from academy to senior football?
Oh, it's not easy for him, that is for sure. It's been tough, hasn't it? They've struggled to score goals, which is obviously the most important aspect of football. They didn't in this game, so that will have delighted him. What I would say is that he's already put his own imprint on the team. It's a 3-4-3, and they're all about short passes. They're playing like a little bit like you'd expect an Arsenal academy side to knock the ball around. Lots of triangles, lots of short, sharp passing. But the issue has been, does it come with the end product? Does it come with the goals? And in this match, it did for them, even though one of them certainly was gifted with Stockport trying to play out from the back. And do you know what? I think that particular goal might prove to be a turning point for Crawley Town. It was the one that Dom Telford dispatched, and it's his first goal. He came, obviously, he's on good wages. They brought him in. It was quite a coup, I think, to sign Dom Telford, and he hadn't scored. They steal the ball inside the opposition box, and he taps in. And I just wonder, will that be lift off for him now in the weeks to come? Hat trick of assists in this game for Sam's buddy Tom Nichols. So well done to him as well. And the winner was a good goal, wasn't it, from Nick Cerullo? I don't know if you've seen it. He'd been suspended for the match at Salford, and he spanked one in from outside the area. So I think things are on the up. They beat Fulham, if you remember, Fulham reserves in the Carabao Cup not long ago, Crawley, and since then they're unbeaten. So it feels like that might have been the night that got their campaign going. As for Stockport, I mean, they've scored. This is a shocking stat for a team of Stockport's ability. They've scored in all four away games and they've lost them all. That can't happen. That can't keep you happening. They've got to have better game management. They've got to be able to see matches out, because the forwards are doing their bit. It's up to the rest of the guys to defend better, because they didn't defend well in this game or all season, really.
Last game we're going to look at has been chosen by former Swindon Town striker Sam Parkin. He'd like to talk about Swindon Town winning. You'll never guess what the score was, listener. Yeah, it was 3-2 in this one as well against Sutton United. How are you feeling about Scott Lindsay's Robins then, Sam?
Well, I'm feeling okay. I'm probably feeling a bit more positive than quite a lot of the natives at the moment. The jury is very much out. And again, it's difficult to put your finger on it, really. There was 33 shots in this game. I've only just noted that down, 17 on the target. And I think the criticism is they just look a little bit too open, Swindon at the moment. Defensively, not very good at all. I think there's probably going to be calls for Baudry maybe to come back in, who's been a big player for Swindon the last few seasons. It's Angus McDonald and Clayton, who they signed from Liverpool in the summer at the moment, who by all accounts has had a decent start to the season, but they're just not collectively looking the business as of yet. And I think the supporters feel that they should be doing better. They've still got Louis Reed. They've still got Johnny Williams, Ben Gladwin. These are, you know, players that shouldn't really be playing in League Two. They've added Luke Jeffcott, and when he was replaced, I think, around about the hour mark, there was the old calls of, you don't know what you're doing, to Scott Lindsay. And the substitute, Jacob Wakelin, who came on for Jeffcott, notches the winner. So, I don't think everyone is completely on the same page right now. So we'll have to see. I like Scott. I've enjoyed being in his company. I think the jury's still out with a lot of the signings that have been brought in. So they need a little bit of time, because this isn't the same Swindon that we saw last year. I don't think we are too sure exactly what the style is. Last year, ridiculously possession-based, you know, very patient in the build-up. I think they're trying to do something similar. The stats aren't too dissimilar. I think they're fourth for average possession in the league, but they did play against Gillingham, who had 10 men for kind of 85 minutes the other day. So that maybe adjusted that in their favour. So I think it's a little bit too early to completely judge them, but definitely it's split in opinion down in the West Country, that's for sure.
It'll be interesting to see how it goes as the season proceeds, but a rude awakening for those Swindon supporters who dared to question their manager.
Jakey Wakey, they're calling him. You can have that.
Nice. All right, that was the midweek roundup. Next today, another EFL legend takes our fit and proper guest test. Right, it's time for the fit and proper guest test, and we are very pleased to welcome Matt Holland to take the test this week. Played in the EFL for Bournemouth, Ipswich and Charlton. Matt, thanks so much for your time today. The first question I want to ask you is, do you remember your Football League debut?
Football League debut, yeah. I came on as a sub for Bournemouth in a 2-0 defeat at home. And I remember it because I ripped my shorts within about 60 seconds of coming on. Went in for a tackle, my shorts completely ripped, and I had to take them off at the dugout a minute after coming on my debut. So, yeah, absolutely remember it.
Were you wearing the captain's armband when you came on for your debut?
No, no, not at that time, no. I had to play a couple of games first, Clarke, before I got the captain's armband, but...
Honestly, I've known Matt since, I think, what were we, 10 or 11, when we went down to Southampton as kids, I remember. And Matt has always been captain every single team.
I don't know why. Tell me why, Clarkie. I've got no idea why.
You're just busy, weren't you? Just
probably.
So busy.
That's exactly what it was.
Not just captain, but player of the year everywhere too. Bournemouth, Ipswich and Charlton. Does that kind of thing rank high in terms of your career achievements? Do you still keep the trophies? Are they doorstops? Are they in the downstairs loo for guests to look at?
They're around. Absolutely no. It's always nice to be recognised, isn't it, by the supporters for having a good season or whatever. So yeah, it's nice to pick up personal accolades. Obviously, the team's the most important thing, but to pick up the personal accolades is quite nice as well.
Sort of jumped in when Clarkie was ribbing you about being captain, Matt, because that's what I think of when I think of you, synonymous, going around clapping the supporters with the old captain's armband on. Who was the most trouble in terms of players trying to manage as captain of the dressing room?
That is a good question. Jim McGilton was always tricky.
Oh, yeah.
Jim McGilton, he was the biggest moaner you've ever come across. Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank was a bit the same as well at Charlton. If you didn't pass directly to Jimmy Floyd's feet, my word, you knew about it. If he had to move 2 yards to one side or the other, crikey, did he let you know. And Jim just wanted the ball all the time. He just moaned, give me the ball, give me the ball, give me the ball, give me the ball. In the end, he said, shut up, Jim. Just shut up. Let me play my game. So those two were pretty tricky at times.
All right. So you got Jim McGilton in your ear. That made things tricky. Visually, you're colourblind as well. And that was something that you had to overcome in your career, wasn't it? It's something that's not spoken about much for footballers.
It's quite a common thing. I mean, there's 1 in 12 men have got colourblindness. So there must be 2 in every squad by that maths. I never really had a major problem with it. Generally, they're pretty good. When you play a match, the two kits generally are quite separate. They're quite different. The one time I had a massive problem was actually... Talking about debuts, you asked me about my debut in the Football League. My debut for Charlton came at Plymouth in a pre-season friendly. We went on a pre-season tour down there. They were in dark green and we only had our home kit, which was red. Well, 5 minutes in, Curbs was in the stand, but Mervyn Day was on the bench. I ran to the bench. I said, Merv, we've got a big problem here. I said, because I can't even see the difference between the two kits. And he went, oh my God, what have we signed? And honestly, that was the only time in my career really where I had a massive point. In training, the bibs sometimes were an issue. The red, the green, the orange bibs were an issue. But Mervyn always was pretty good at separating those and making sure I didn't have an issue. But the only time I had a real problem in the game was that one.
How bad is it then? What is it that you can see or can't see?
Do you know what? I mean, because I've never known any different, I don't know really. I mean, reds, if you do the colourblind test, when you go to the doctors, you get the colours, the numbers, you get the coloured dots, don't you? And you have to see a certain number. There's certain things that I just can't see. So reds and greens are a problem. Blues and purples are an issue. The grass looks orange. So there's all sorts of things that I just don't know any different though. That's as a kid, sort of 5 or 6, I remember my mum having the test at the doctors and they were telling me I was colourblind. I've just never known any different.
It's amazing. Yeah, really, really impressive that you managed to deal with it so well.
Well, that's always a good excuse when you gave the ball away.
Yeah, can't see you.
Colours, could I?
I'm going to give you a tough question now, Matt. You can only promote one team from League One this season, Ipswich or Charlton. Who are you picking?
That's a good one. I think I'll probably have to go with it, Ipswich this season. I've been privileged really to have been down there quite a bit this season already. Been able to go and watch training with Kieran McKenna in charge. I'm on the board of the charitable arm of the football club as well. So I'm a trustee of the Ipswich Town Foundation. So I was there the other night actually when I saw them win 2-0 against Bristol Rovers. And it's been a long time. They've been out the Premier League for such a long time. But where they are at the moment, they seem in a good place. They're in a good place with the ownership. The chief executive, Mark Ashton's doing a good job. And Kieran McKenna, honestly, watching him coach, he's just top draw. So I'll probably just have to go with them this year and then Charlton can go up next season.
On that then, Matt, we asked Dean Ashton for his favourite career goal the other day and he plucked out an overhead kick at Old Trafford. So I'm not letting you have your World Cup goal. Favourite Ipswich goal then?
Favourite Ipswich goal? Good question. Do you know what? Ironically, probably my favourite goal came against Charlton because it was my first Premier League goal. So I sort of started the season and I'd picked up an ankle injury in the second game against Man United. And I was sort of having a slow start to the season. Took me a little while to get into the rhythm. And I scored against Charlton in a 2-0 win. So my first Premier League goal is always one that you're going to remember. My son's favourite goal I scored was in the playoff semi-final against Bolton. The first goal I scored in that one, I ran from inside the own half, ran off Klaus Jensen and managed to score. I actually scored two in the game, but the first one I scored in that match probably was my son's favourite goal.
I watched that on YouTube the other day. It popped up on Twitter, didn't it? I think
yeah,
the other
it
day.
It was, yeah, it was I think we were discussing, because of Marcus Stewart, actually, it came up because obviously he played a huge part in the season that we got promoted. And I always call it Marcus Stewart Day, the two goals that he scored away at Bolton when we were struggling in that game. And he popped up with two unbelievable goals, two very different goals. So I think that's why it popped up on Twitter. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, really sad news. What's happened to him? Wish him all the best, of course. I've got a couple of questions. I want to get them in before we let you go. One is, which teammate that you played with during your time in the EFL do you think should have made it to the big time but didn't? And the other one is George Burley or Alan Kirbishley? Because you're a son of both. which one are you picking?
So, yeah, cool. Really difficult questions there. Oh, blimey. Because I always find it difficult to pick managers because they're all so different and there's so many different... Like Mel Machin, for instance, my first sort of manager in the Football League was Mel Machin. And the responsibility that he gave me at such a young age was frightening, really. I mean, like, when I look back, I was only 21 and he made me captain and he leant heavily on me as to try and find out how the feeling was in the dressing room and all that sort. I had a cup of tea with him in his office every morning. He'd just go, how's he? How's he getting on? What do you think of this? Do you think we're training too hard? Do you think we should do this? Do you think we should do that? And I was 21. I've hardly played any football. And honestly, some of the conversations that we had, he made me, I think, a better leader by doing that at such a young age, to be honest. So he had a massive influence on me. In terms of making me a better player, George Burley spent hours on the training ground. Honestly, I mean, George was a perfectionist and he worked heavily on me as an individual. I joined Ipswich at 23 and there was still lots of in my game that needed to improve. George had an analogy of footballers and golf clubs. So he always used to say to me, you've got the driver, you've got the four iron, you haven't got the sandwich. You've got to find a sandwich. You've got to be able to just fill one into the channel at times. He said, you always try and just lace it and put it into an area. And he said, you've now got to get a bit of finesse in your game. He said, fine driving the ball, but now you need to get the little sandwich and the little lob shots around the green. So he worked heavily on that with me, opening my body up, trying to get on the half turn, all those things. And Kerbs, again, I mean, I signed at 29 at Charlton and he made me captain straight away. And we had a really great relationship as well. So I always find that really, really difficult to answer.
Answer
who did I think should have done much better than they did? Crikey. I mean, really, again, another really good question. Who did I have? Who do we have? I'm trying to think of all the clubs I played at. I'm trying to go back to Bournemouth, really. My days at Bournemouth. I'll tell you who was a brilliant player. Maybe didn't get the recognition he should have done. Was Ian Cox, centre half. He played at Burnley and he played higher up, but he was someone that, honestly, such an elegant defender, really quick, read the game, so placid, so relaxed, never panicked. He was someone that maybe could have gone on a little bit further. Scott Mean was another one. He actually went to West Ham, but he picked up a really bad injury. And he made the move to West Ham from Bournemouth before I got a move to Ipswich. But he picked up a bad injury at West Ham. So he's another one who could have done better as well.
Right, they're the easy questions out of the way. We always finish with a really tough one, Matt. So what I want to know is, where do you rank yourself on the list of players whose surnames are countries? So I'm talking Alan Brazil, Jason Scotland, Mike England, Stephen Ireland, Joe Jordan and Patsy Holland. You above all of those? You mid-table? What are you thinking?
Yeah, I wouldn't put myself above them all. No, I don't think I scored five against Man United. And he's much better at the social side of the game than I was as well, Alan Brazil. So he might well top the list. Crikey. I'll go mid-table. I think mid-table's a fair reflection.
All right, yeah, I think that's modest enough. We'd probably have you top, but yeah, we'll say mid-table. Adrian, Sam, what do we think? Has Matt passed the fit and proper guest test?
Hands down, yeah. But flying colours, I'd say.
I'll take Sam. It.
For the bookcase cabinet alone.
They're all DVDs. It makes me look intelligent.
Matt, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. We'll speak to you soon.
No problem at all. Good to speak to you guys.
Right, Clarky, you want to talk about shapes?
I do. Yeah, let's go to the whiteboard, shall we? I got myself into a bit of a sort of black hole researching this. I had to keep looking and keep looking. I thought, you know what, this is interesting and I want to share it with people. In this week's midweek round of championship matches, 19 of the 24 teams started with a back three. I just think that's incredible. I mean, in England, in English football, We've long been the advocates of the back four, and you know, around the world, you look around the Premier League, there's a nice mix, I think, between back fours and back threes. It's not as if back threes have taken over the world, but in the Championship they have. Quite remarkable. Only three teams actually this season in the Championship haven't used a back three, and that's Norwich, West Bromwich Albion and Burnley. So yeah, lots of different incarnations of it as well. There's 3-4-1-2, which is the most popular. Then there's 3-4-3, 3-5-2, 3-4-2-1, 3-1-4-2, and even a 3-5-1-1 thrown in, plus a 5-3-2. So back three is one thing, but then what goes on ahead of it is quite remarkable. So 19 of 24 in midweek used it in the Championship. 14 of the 24 teams in League One went with a back three on Tuesday night as well. 10 of those had a front two. And I think that's the crucial thing. I think a lot of teams down the pyramid want to play with a twin strike force. They want to cause opponents problems. And they feel safer doing it with a back three. And into League Two, the drop-off actually does continue. So you go from 19 to 14. And in League Two, it's 11. It's still 11 of 24 teams that went with the back three in midweek. So that's 44 of 72. That equates to 61%. They are the fashion of choice at the moment in terms of formations. And I thought I'd share that with the listeners.
I'm sure they enjoyed it. But as the possessor of a grade E in GCSE mathematics, that was pretty baffling for me, to be honest. All those back threes, have they got anything to do with all the 3-2s we saw this midweek? No, probably not. Right. OK, so back threes, one thing to keep an eye on. Something that Sam's been having a close look at are Queen's Park Rangers under, don't call him Michael, Mick Beale. You were at the Den on Wednesday night, Sam. Tell us a bit about that game, but also tell us a bit about your beloved QPR and their new manager, because it's going pretty well.
Well, this was a very, very comfortable 2-0. I'll say first and foremost, as bad as I can remember seeing Millwall in recent memory, took me a little by surprise just how toothless they were. I think you just expect going to the Den, absolute cliche, but the first 20 minutes, irrelevant of the the size of the task in front of them, even if it's a top Championship side, Premier League side even, you expect to come under pressure and the goalkeeper to be worked. There was nothing of that last night. It was a very comfortable victory for Rangers. And yeah, just I thought an opportunity for me to just wax lyrical about QPR. Mm-hmm. And in particular, my first point, Ilias Chair and Chris Willock. I mean, Chris Willock could be the best player in the Championship right now. I think he's phenomenal. And we think of Rodney Marsh, Stan Bowles, I'm getting nostalgic here, Roy Wegley, one of my heroes, those beautifully gifted number 10s. In the modern era, Eze, probably my favourite QPR player of the last 10 years or so.
Tarapt,
I was probably playing, it was not my favourite team ever. I didn't go and see them that often. And I think the character's got to come into it a little bit. They've got to be likeable. And I don't think he particularly was, maybe, if I'm allowed to say that. So I think as a duo, this is something beautiful, so unique. Last night, Chair and Willock just played 1-2s. I mean, there must be a nightmare for their teammates in training. Can you imagine, Clark? You can't get the ball off them. Mm-hmm. But last night, they are just absolute poetry when they're at it. And obviously, Chair made the two goals. Willock's, that's kind of his signature goal, isn't it? Coming in from the left-hand side and bending shots into the far post. So again, they are going to be the difference for QPR in so many games. And Mick Beale has kind of gone all in on attacking midfielders because he couldn't get that centre forward. He couldn't find one. They haven't got one. They've got Dykes, who's obviously not in great form. And they've got Tyler Roberts, who plays the elusive false nine role. Didn't do it badly last night, but they're probably going to get away with not having an out-and-out striker because those two are so majestic. And they won that game for Rangers last night. My second point, set pieces. I just thought this was a lovely story. Mick Beale appointed Harry Watling in the summer as his kind of assistant coach, but a set piece specialist as well. First met when Beale was doing futsal classes in a church in Bromley. And he was 12 years old, this boy, Harry Watling, when he turned up, one of three children at the first class, and subsequently worked with Beale at Chelsea and at Millwall, went off to the States to be a manager in his own right, but has come back to work with Mick Beale. And they've got the joint most set piece goals. And anyone who hasn't seen it, the goal last night, Johansson, short corner from Chair, terrible from Millwall. I mean, it was absolutely abysmal. But he seems to be working wonders. So I thought I'd give him a little bit of a shout out. And just this upturn, recent upturn, I think a lot about the fullbacks. Last night, Kenneth Pohl was absolutely amazing. And I saw him against Blackpool about a month ago, and he was horrific. I thought they'd made an absolute rick. And it's been the problem area for Rangers, the two fullbacks. You think of the setup, they're not playing with wingers. They play with two number 10s in a 4-3-3, which I think is quite unique in itself. Clarke, you can come in here maybe, but they don't have any whip from the three midfield boys, and they play with two 10s. So the two fullbacks have just got this license to go and bomb on and create danger in the final third. Laird's doing more so in terms of the creativity, getting to the byline. But Pohl, goodness me, his tenacity, winning headers on the far post when Mill were trying to put him under pressure, his decision-making with the ball, his passing so crisp. He looks like a real find as well. So I think the system, but because of those two fullbacks, is really, really interesting and very unique. I can't remember another team really playing like this. So we are starting to see Mick Beale and his imprint at Rangers, absolutely. Whether it's enough for another challenge at the playoffs, we'll have to wait and see. And we'll have to wait and see if they can get away without doing it with a big, ugly number nine.
It sounds a bit Christmas tree-ish, like a sort of 4-3-2-1. If you cast your mind back to Euro 96, that was...
I was just thinking that. It was going to be why Alan Shearer didn't score any goals, wasn't it, Euro 96? He wasn't the right star on top of the Christmas tree.
But what you'll remember from that was, you know, the fullbacks flying down the wing. And obviously, what the key there is, if you got a couple of central midfielders that can sort of hold the fort while the fullbacks fly forward to in effect... Keep enough players back when you're going forward, but yeah, it's an interesting setup, that is for sure. I was just going to ask Sam very quickly: is there a potential? I know it's working well for QPR, so why would they change it? But if Roberts is injured, for example, and if Dykes isn't worth his place in the team, could there be a situation where you just play them as a front two like a floating front two? Or do you think that would take too much away from linking the midfield to the attack?
Yeah, I'd probably side with the latter. Mm. But it's a good point, Clarke, because last night they had three floating around. Honestly, it's, you know, it's very, very unique. I think that one of my further points, if we had the time, he could go to a 3-4-3, I think, because I think he'd like to play with the back three. And Clarke Salter has been purchased for that purpose, to play on the left of a three. So this is maybe him thinking on his feet right now as well. And the point you made there about the midfield, Clarke, kind of holding their position, they've almost got three players that don't get in advanced positions of the ball. I looked it up this morning. They had two touches in the opponent's box, the midfield players, collectively, last night. One was Johansson's goal, and the other one, I'm going to slow down here, was Irobinum's shot very early on, the loanee from Aston Villa. And he does look to have a little bit in terms of going past people and joining in. But last night, you've got Field, you got Johansson, and you got the aforementioned young lad, who I'm not going to say again, doing a very similar job, just allowing Chairman Willock and Roberts, you go and play with the two fullbacks.
5 and 5. That's what the coaches work on now. You look at any formation at any given time, you'll have five players that are attacking and five that are protecting. It's what they're all doing. But I think QPR's setup is definitely unusual. I like it. It's great.
There you go, listener. Keep your eye out for back threes this weekend and how QPR get on against Stoke. That is a tasty game. Maybe we'll have a look back at that when we do our next show on Monday. All right, seeing as we're later, we thought rather than preview games that you might well be on your way to now, listener, or on your way back from, indeed, we'd make some predictions. A couple of games from each league. Starting with Swansea Hull. This is the way to kick off this feature, Adrian. I've gone for a 0-0 draw. How about you?
Swansea against Hull, 0-0. Do you know what? It's occurred to me, this could be sponsored, couldn't it? This section could be sponsored. There you go, some predictions. But there you go.
EFL@yahoo.com if you want to do it.
Are you saying that because I won a few quid last night, Clarke?
You did. It was a very good little accumulator that you put together. Well played. So Swansea Hull, very quickly. Yeah, I don't see a high scoring game here. I do think Swansea might nick it though, 1-0.
Okay, Sam, what you got?
Ditto. So I'm going to change just for the fun of it. I'll go 1-0 Hull City.
Ooh, 0-1. Nice. Okay. So a bit of kind of Alan Turing vibes there. 0-0, 1-0, 0-1. Not going to be a great one. Norwich, West Brom. This ought to be a bit better. I mean, how many times is Steve Bruce going to go back to a former club? This is ridiculous. He's doing so again this weekend. I'm saying he's going to be on the end of a 3-1 defeat. Sam, what do you think?
I don't think Norwich can maintain this any longer, especially when they come up against a good side with lots of attacking threat. So I'm thinking goals, I'm thinking 4, and I'm thinking 2 each.
Okay, 2-2 draw. Nice. Adrian, any
advice? I had that originally, and then I changed my mind because I was putting this together when the games were on in midweek, and Birmingham were battering West Brom, so I've changed it. It's going to be Norwich 2, West Brom 1.
Okay. Bit closer than I think, but still a home win. Into League One, like the look of this game, Bolton versus Peterborough United. What do you think, Adrian?
2-2 for me. I think Peterborough are better than their recent results suggest. I think they're desperate to get something. It won't be easy against Bolton, but I think they're capable. So, yeah, 2 apiece.
Posh Trotters. What do you think, Sam?
Well, Bolton are getting loads of praise right now. I think the collective is really strong. So I fancy them to be on the score sheet again. But I think Peterborough, having lost at home against Fleetwood and not scored, that's not going to happen too often. The two front boys are going to be furious. They're going to get 2-3.
Ooh, nice. Game of the day. I've gone for a 2-1 Bolton win in that one. I think they call this one the Dockyard Derby, Portsmouth versus Plymouth, two of the contenders at the top of League One, actually very, very far away from one another geographically. I'm going to say 2-2 in this one. How about you, Adrian?
Yeah, 2-1 to Pompey for me, just home advantage counting. But yeah, two decent teams, very decent.
Same as Clarke, 1-0 Portsmouth, I think. Plymouth struggling a little bit away from home. I know they won at Derby, but not the force they are at Home Park.
All right, into League Two. Mark Hughes versus Steve Evans. How's that for a stylistic matchup? Bradford versus Stevenage. I'm going 1-0 to the Bantams. Sam, what do you think?
I've completely lost my notes, but I was thinking along the same lines, although I'll go for a 1-1.
Okay, close game. Adrian?
Goalless draw for me. I think Steve Evans will gladly try and ruin this afternoon for Mark Hughes. And Stevenage, I think, are capable of doing that. So, yeah, 0-0.
Lastly, I've picked Newport v Barrow, largely so I can say Rodney Parade. I don't think that the locals are going to be that happy there, though. I think Barrow, Pete Wild, new contract and all, are going to win 2-1. Adrian, is it going to be an away win, a home win or a draw?
Curse of the new contract. Newport desperate to turn the tide around. I think they're better than results suggest. They're going to go for it here. 3-2, because there were so many 3-2s in midweek. Let's go with another one here. 3-2 Newport.
Sam?
Were you 2-1 Newport, Matt?
I was 2-1 Barrow.
Oh, were you? I love 2-1 Newport. I think they are such a mixed bag. Got some good forward players. And yeah, I think Barrow's, despite the stats looking good and backing up their good start, I think the wheels may come off there. 2-1 Newport.
All right, we'll revisit those on Monday. And like Adrian says, this spot is ripe for a sponsor. Email whattheefl@yahoo.com. If you would like to be that person, give us a follow as well, if you'd be so kind, at EFL What The. We are on Twitter. Speaking of Twitter, before we go, Sam, I, of course, have a footballer's tweet for you to analyse. It comes from Blackburn's Ryan Hedges. He's continuing the theme of quote tweeting the official club account with a picture of him sliding on his knees in celebration after he scored against Watford on Tuesday. He says, unreal feeling to finally get off the mark for this great club. A big 3 points at home, and what a shift from the lads. Praise emoji, football emoji, at Rovers. Hitting all the key marking points there, isn't he?
Yes. It's a 3 out of 10. I don't like great shift from the lads, because there would have been someone who would have been below par. So, and how can you be
just
tweeting?
Be Watford.
How
be
can
Watford.
You be tweeting about your goal when a geezer has scored maybe the best goal of all time in the same game?
This is true.
Big up, Dominic Hyam.
Adrian, how much more respect would you have for Ryan Hedges if he'd said, big shift from the lads, apart from Hyam, who shanked one in and did absolutely nothing else for the subsequent 89 minutes.
That's the kind of tweet gold that we're looking for, isn't it? But Sam struck the right chord here. Shouldn't have been the tweet about his own goal. Should have been the tweet about his buddy, because that was the big moment, wasn't it?
Is there a hedge emoji available? Because that would have knocked him up a bit.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he should come on for a sponsored bit called Hedge Your Bets or something. But he can't do that because he's a current footballer and he would get banned. But hey, we're spitballing ideas here, guys. We're in our infancy. Supporters, if you can, please, a 5-star review would be very helpful, as would telling a mate if they like the EFL, because we're going to be here every week talking about it. What a pleasure it was to have Matt Holland on the show earlier. Many thanks to him, to Adrian, to Sam as well, and to producer Marley for knocking all this into some kind of shape. We'll be back with you next week to run through all the big EFL stories. Have a great weekend. Enjoy the football, and we'll catch up with you soon.